Now the job facing the nation today is to get rid of poverty. We are the richest nation in the history of the world. Our national gross product this year is about $800 billion. That is what it is, the richest nation in the history of the world. It wouldn't take much to do what I'm talking about. It wouldn't take a great percentage of that national gross product to do what I'm talking about. If the haves are willing to somehow join hands with the have-nots and armed with compassionate traveler's checks, journey into that other country of their brother's hurt and denial and neglect, it wouldn't take that much. We've done it before.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. While much of the country remembers Martin Luther King Jr. as primarily a leader of civil rights and desegregation and a great orator, our next guests say he stood for so much more. But many aspects of his life, legacy, and philosophy remain either unknown or conveniently forgotten. We are joined by three experts. David Garrow is a professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His publications include The FBI in Martin Luther King Jr., Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he is co-editor of The Eyes on the Prize Civil Rights Reader. He also served as senior advisor for Eyes on the Prize, the award-winning PBS television history series. Thomas Jackson is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's the author of From Civil Rights to Human Rights, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Struggle for Economic Justice. Joshua Inwood is a professor of geography and Africana studies at the University of Tennessee. His publications include Searching for the Promised Land, Examining Dr. Martin Luther King's Concept of the Beloved Community, and Street Naming and the Politics of Belongings. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Thomas Jackson, you wrote in your book, From Civil Rights to Human Rights, that to understand Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. fully, we must understand who inspired him and whom he sought to persuade. Who did inspire him and who did he seek to persuade?
That is a great and sweeping question. One of the theses of my book is that there's a remarkable consistency over his life course in the degree to which he thought that you couldn't really achieve racial justice without economic justice and indeed without addressing issues of international peace. And that seems to be just a consistent thread throughout his life. First of all, his father and grandfather inspired him as sort of social gospel ministers dedicated to serving their communities. When he was in college and then graduate school, people like Howard Thurman, dean of chapel at Boston University, he was influenced by Reinhold Niebuhr, the socialist theologian in Detroit. His reading of Walter Rauschenbusch from the 19th century, a social gospel minister. This is sort of social gospel or even socialist Protestant thinkers and preachers. And that was quite formative. But there's a whole list of people, a whole group of them around Howard University who had been influenced by Gandhi as well, but also by egalitarian and revolutionary idea of Christianity. He sought to persuade everybody. He sought to persuade and bring together what you would need to produce a national reform constituency first, and then what he hoped would be a revolution of values. So principally, he was speaking to black communities to get them committed and mobilized for protest, and that was a rhetoric of black unity and Christian service. He sought to speak to the vast middle-class majority, the electorate, in terms that would appeal to their sense of patriotism, but also fairness and justice, and in many ways their religious commitment to the least among them. And he sought to persuade policy elites. So he had a whole circle of advisors, and David Garrow knows a lot about this because he's unearthed a lot of it. But he sought to be an advocate, not only for civil rights legislation, but beyond that, for a robust war on poverty that would include things like job creation and free medical care on models that he saw in Scandinavia and Western Europe. He was also someone who self-consciously spoke to the world. I think if you look at his Nobel acceptance speech and his Nobel lecture, go to that and see the degree to which, as a kind of prophetic Christian leader, he thought that he really needed to speak to issues of international peace and economic distribution.
David Garrow,
The first thing for listeners to appreciate about Dr. King was that he was first and foremost a Baptist minister. King identified as a preacher. The Dr. King that you can hear in the recorded church sermons which have survived is almost always oftentimes a more powerful, more personal, more striking speaker than when you listen to King giving a civil rights talk at some college or university, for example. Both when he was in seminary at Crozer Theological Seminary, when he's in graduate school at Boston, as Tom mentioned, good many of the theologians and thinkers that he read during those school years, Reinhold Niebuhr in particular, had a significant impact on him. But more often than anything else, King is speaking from the Bible.
Joshua Inwood.
You know, as a geographer, I think one of the things that I find so interesting about King is he leads this movement that is arguably the most transformative to the spaces and places of the United States, at least since first contact with white Europeans with Native Americans. And I think the thing that you have to keep in mind with King, and I think when you think about King, is at his most basic level, he makes an argument for the way that we should live and connect with each other in the idea of community. And when I think about King and when I think about the things that really inspired him and some of the intellectual currents that he draws from that both Tom and David allude to in their work, it is that connection to space and place, which is very important to understand his transformative power as a social thinker and as a social revolutionary.
Josh Inwood, there's a concept that you articulated in one of your papers, which was the beloved community. How do you explain this?
As both David and Thomas talked about, King is first and foremost a Baptist minister, but King is also able to draw from both intellectual currents, European intellectual currents, and also currents within the African-American community to really articulate a kind of idea of community that he talks about as the beloved community, which is really a space where all lives are interconnected and respected, and where he hopes you can transform individual lives through the transformative power of what he talks about as agape love. And so for King, he really makes distinctions between these three forms of love, between an eros, which is a kind of romantic love, philia, which is the kind of love and companionship that friendship has. But then he talks about agape. And at its most basic level, agape is the ability to tell your oppressor that what you're doing to me is not only wrong and dehumanizes me, but it also dehumanizes you. And so when King is articulating this notion of a beloved community, he is really talking and working and thinking about the transforming of these relationships, both black-white relationships, but also ultimately, as Thomas outlines in his book, you know, he's really building towards this economic argument that its final manifestation in the Poor People's Campaign. If you go back and you look at the Poor People's Campaign and what King was trying to do in 1967 and 1968, particularly in Washington, D.C., getting people to come to Washington, that is the manifestation of what that beloved community is. And there was a whole political program that was tied to the Poor People's Campaign, everything from a kind of guaranteed national income to universal health care, to also trying to get folks to understand and engage with one another in a different kind of level than had been going on in the 1960s in the United States.
This leads to an aspect that all three of you have discussed in your papers about the difference between the memory of Martin Luther King Jr. and the reality of it. Thomas Jackson, you wrote that we remember him, Dr. King, primarily as the leader of the civil rights movement that would end legal segregation. But really, his philosophy was so much broader and so much deeper than this memory of him. What more do we need to understand about the omissions to understand him? And why do you think we have these omissions?
We tend to freeze him in time and think that he didn't develop or address issues like the Vietnam War or like these deeper issues of poverty that revealed themselves to be so intractable after the Civil Rights Act. So we tend to remember and freeze him in time and identify him with the dream. In order to get a national holiday the nation, I think, needed to arrive at a more of a consensus picture of who this man was. Even though Mrs. King, in the congressional hearings, said, here is your opportunity, nation, to make a national holiday and to celebrate a man who died in the service of labor rights for the sanitation workers of Memphis. But that is, as you suggest, occluded or elided in our consensus national celebrations, and nothing more evident than in the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. There are other communities, though, and you've heard of some samplings already, of people who remember different things that he said to audiences he was appealing to. Michael Honey, written a lot about King as a labor leader and who tried to forge a black labor alliance with so many unions. He didn't go on picket lines all the time, but rhetorically and in terms of his vision, it was very much one in which workers' rights and the rights especially to decent wages and collective bargaining protections were as sacred as the rights to life and liberty. So I think we don't remember that for the same reason that we have business pages of newspapers and not labor pages of newspapers. So there's a lot of contestation. I mean, a lot of people want to claim King as an opponent of affirmative action, or I got into an argument with his niece, whether he would have been a Republican today or not. So in order for the nation to celebrate him every year, there seems to be a least common denominator, but the richness of his activism and his life lives on, and you can see it in all these groups that try to keep his memory alive, especially the peace groups at the March on Washington last August, who were directly challenging the Obama administration's policies abroad in using King's words. There's a lot of debate and contestation within that legacy. It's not like it's a frozen or one-dimensional legacy.
David Garrow, you too have emphasized these omitted aspects. You actually used the word distorted in terms of Dr. King's vision. What do you see as the distortions?
I think most listeners are probably quite unfamiliar with how Dr. King sounded during the last 3 years of his life, 1966 to 1968. The King of those years was a very harshly spoken critic, not only of American foreign policy and the war in Vietnam, but of economic inequality here in the United States. And both in terms of what we can correctly label a democratic socialist economic vision that he's articulating those years, and how he, in very tough language, is denouncing the U.S. government's military behavior in Southeast Asia, King is a much tougher critic of the United States and American society than is really ever underscored at January holiday celebration.
Joshua Inwood, you haven't used the word distortion, but you noted some contradictions, particularly around this issue of militarism.
I very much agree with what David just said. King did not mince words when he talked about the triple evils of modern society, what he refers to as racism, materialism, and militarism. When he speaks to materialism, he's really thinking about kind of the unfettered capital accumulation that is both going on in the United States, but then also spreading throughout the world. And I think really if listeners want to get into this in a way and really try to understand how King had changed and how he had come to terms with American both militarism and capitalism, you really need to turn to his book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community. And in many respects, this is King's most radical work. And King is unabashed when he talks about how American military soldiers who are standing in solidarity and burning villages in Vietnam would never be able to live on the same street in Detroit, Michigan. It's interesting that we're having this conversation in the backdrop of the NSA leaks from Edward Snowden, and President Obama was just giving a speech talking about some of the reforms that he would like to see. In many respects, you go back and you look at King in the 1960s, and we are still struggling and still trying to come to terms with many of those triple evils in society. We have got governors throughout this country who refuse to expand Medicaid rolls for poor and low-income folks, who very much practice a kind of economic revanchism in engaging with poor communities. We have a government who is at least potentially wrapping up American citizens in surveillance. And if you think about King's life in terms of the COINTEL program, it's the same kinds of things that he spoke about. We are also in the midst of debates in the Congress where we have seen long-term unemployment benefits cut from poor and working people who have been unable to find jobs. We've got food stamp cuts that have been enacted or being debated. And we really are struggling again with those things that King talked about, particularly as it relates to those triple evils of modern society.
That's a perfect place to go into some of the struggles that he did face and the FBI surveillance of Dr. King. But let me first remind our listeners that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're talking with Joshua Inwood, David Garrow, and Thomas Jackson, who are experts on Martin Luther King. David Garrow, you've looked at the FBI's surveillance of Dr. King.
The FBI first began targeting Dr. King in 1962 and 1963 in the belief that he probably was being influenced by certainly one or more than one advisors who had previously been secretly active in and loyal to the American Communist Party in the early 1950s. So that hypothesis is what leads Robert Kennedy, as U.S. Attorney General, to authorize the wiretapping of Dr. King. The FBI, on its own, without any approval from the Attorney General, also begins using bugs as electronic recording devices, as distinct from telephone wiretaps, against Dr. King. And all of that electronic surveillance quickly leads the FBI into an entirely prurient interest in Dr. King's private life. So you have really incredibly distasteful government surveillance being targeted at King during all of the mid-1960s. But the FBI's surveillance of Dr. King was not unique. They were deploying even more electronic attention towards, for instance, the Nation of Islam, a quite small black sect that had really very little influence on anything. But the echoes of the FBI's behavior during the 1960s and early 1970s, with the scope of government surveillance practices that we've all read about in recent months, is a very, very powerful echo.
You mentioned RFK's authorization of the wiretap. How did the relationship eventuate between RFK, JFK, and Martin Luther King Jr.?
Both of the Kennedy brothers, from May and June of 1963 onward, were very strongly supportive of the civil rights movement and very actively in concert with Dr. King, notwithstanding what J. Edgar Hoover's FBI is consistently whispering in their ears. The same pattern then continues when Lyndon Johnson becomes president after John F. Kennedy's assassination. Johnson very courageously stands with King and the movement, especially in 1965, in putting forward the Voting Rights Act. But secretly behind the scenes, Johnson and scores of others know that the FBI is distributing and trying to peddle both these communist influence allegations and all of this detail about King's private life. But under the journalistic standards of the 1960s, nobody, television or newspapers, is actually using any of that FBI rumor. So there's a weird disjuncture between what people in government know privately and the public record of broadcast and news.
May I jump in here? It's Tom Jackson.
Yes.
I want to support that, but also, perhaps way qualify or complicated. I agree. I don't think King was. I think he might have been concerned and maybe a bit intimidated, but it didn't suppress what he was willing to go out on a limb on. And I think the work I'm doing right now in 1963 and 1964 suggests that King and a number of other civil rights leaders, while working in concert with Kennedy and Johnson, also tried to put pressure for more, especially for more robust economic policies, but also for more vigorous protection for civil rights and civil liberties in Southern voting rights campaigns where people were being murdered and brutalized. So that when David talks about King's radicalism from 66 to 68, I see that already in 63 and 64. And it's the FBI can't suppress things that he says. There's a speech when he returns from his Nobel Prize. And it's not the FBI, it's the New York Times that doesn't get the word out. He comes back, first of all, the Times quotes him as basically saying, "I'm returning with a conviction that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time." Well, sitting there in the audience is Robert Wagner, mayor of New York, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, and later on that night, the same speech Malcolm X hears. What King actually says in this speech, and hasn't yet been published, is that before he went to Oslo, he thought the war on poverty, it's the 50th anniversary this week of the war on poverty, he thought it'd be a step in the direction of establishing economic justice. And he was encouraged by the Pope's powerful message on poverty after his visit to India, that nations really need to cease their armament race and devote themselves to assisting those who lack food, clothing, shelter, and medical care. He says, though, in Norway and Sweden, whose economies are literally dwarfed by the size of our affluence and the extent of our technology, they have no unemployment and no slums. Men, women, and children have long enjoyed free medical care and quality education. And he says, this contrast to the limiting and halting steps of the war on poverty, our rich nation is deeply troubling when more than 40 million Americans, white and Negro, live in grinding poverty. Today, that number hasn't basically changed. It's a bit more. The poverty rate, ironically, is higher today. So he was speaking to these issues back in that era of civil rights reform and cooperation with liberalism. But the press wasn't picking up on the message. If you listen to the audio tape of him talking to John Kennedy immediately after the March on Washington, he and the rest of the civil rights leadership is saying, we need full employment. We need a jobs program. We need something much more vigorous than what you're offering. And Kennedy kind of deflects them and says, no, we need you to support the civil rights bill and to exert your influence on Republicans. So there is both cooperation and kind of challenge and conflict going on, even in that period, on these very issues that most people think only emerged later. They were already on the table in 63 and 64.
Thomas Jackson, since you're talking about the media, there's a section of your book that talks about how the media obsesses about violence and really makes the story about violence. And perhaps that's why they're emphasizing the nonviolent talk. But I think you even have a quote in your book about how they are tallying up broken heads.
Box scores of broken heads. That's a quote from Pat Waters, a famous journalist of the Southern Movement, when he's denouncing the way in which newspapers covered the essentially nonviolent black movement. They're basically, what's newsworthy is when these things become violent and there's a fight. But I do think that it's kind of a huge smokescreen. When you look at the March on Washington, for example, half the news coverage is about, is this going to turn violent? How do we avoid violence? What logistics of control are necessary to prevent violence? And then after the march, what a relief that it was nonviolent and how praiseworthy that the Negro leadership was able to keep it nonviolent. And so that obsession with violence is very much noise and tends to drown out some of the substantive grievances and demands like civil liberties, protections, or jobs.
Joshua Inwood, let's put this into a geographic context. One way that you've looked at this is how memory has been created through, say, naming street signs after Martin Luther King and such.
There's kind of two ways to think about that. And we've talked a bit about the way that King is memorialized and the way that King is remembered. And the thing about memorials are, it's a way of concretizing an image. You can see that in the Washington, D.C. memorial, where you've got that image of King and that larger statue and the words that are inscribed in the monument. And it's really a kind of moment for us to think about and to recall certain aspects of King's legacy. But in recalling certain aspects of King's legacy, we are also forgetting other aspects of King's legacy. And so I think we always have to be a little bit careful when we start to memorialize leaders. And I think it's incredibly important where you have someone like King, who really is a social revolutionary, about how we kind of come to think about him and how we come to memorialize him. But I think it's also important to remember as well on King Day that King's work was only possible because there were thousands of others who were willing to not only take to the streets, but to do the hardcore political organizing that is necessary for someone like King and his mission and his activism to have success. And you can see that in countless spaces and countless places, particularly in the American South. If you go to Alabama, if you go to Mississippi, there's a lot of folks there who are working very hard behind the scenes to register people for the NAACP, to register people for the right to vote. That's what King is able to draw on and draw from when the political conditions come together to make his activism possible. We tend to think about King as just emerging here in the 1950s as kind of this great leader. But the reason he was able to emerge in the 1950s with the Montgomery bus boycott is because the political conditions had been created because of decades of struggle that had come before it. So that is something that is very important to think about as we think about 21st century American spaces and places, and with the ways that we can engage in the contemporary struggle to take on many of the inequalities that Thomas just alluded to. Because, I mean, unemployment or poverty, for example, we still live with large numbers of poor people despite the fact that we've been, quote unquote, at war with poverty for 50 years. So that is something I think that listeners need to pay special attention to on King Day and when thinking about King and his legacy and what he means both to us and for us as a nation.
There are two things that brings up. One is the celebrity obsession that our culture has that does discount the rest of the community.
Yeah.
The other aspect, which I think this was also in Thomas Jackson's book, dealt with King as the mediator between the sort of moderate and militant movements for civil rights. He thought they were both ineffective on their own.
No question about it. I think another thing that we have to keep in mind about King's legacy is there was also a very conservative African-American element that was as distrustful of King as some of the more radical elements in the African-American community. And so King is constantly buffered between these different aspects of the African-American community, these different parts of the African-American community, as he is trying to navigate this very complex political situation that presents itself in the 1960s in the United States.
David Garrow.
Certainly. Josh made perhaps the most important point of all, and that's that the civil rights struggle was a mass movement. Yeah. People think of King as the leader of it, but it's more accurate to think of him as a spokesperson for it. In the Nobel Prize context, he stressed that he was a trustee representing all of these tens of thousands of other people. He indeed should be seen as a representative of others and not just as a singular leader.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for your work and thank you for sharing it with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you,
thank
Maria.
Thank you very much.
It's been great. Pleasure.
David Garrow is a professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His publications include The FBI in Martin Luther King Jr., Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he is co-editor of The Eyes on the Prize, Civil Rights Reader. Thomas Jackson is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's the author of From Civil Rights to Human Rights, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Struggle for Economic Justice. Joshua Inwood is a professor of geography and Africana studies at the University of Tennessee. His publications include Searching for the Promised Land, Examining Dr. Martin Luther King's Concept of the Beloved Community, and Street Naming and the Politics of Belonging. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. An extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produced this show each week, and to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @armudian. See you next week.